It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Do you remember what it was like to fall in love? That slow process of getting to know someone, letting them see you, the real you, not your social mask, sharing dreams and telling secrets. It can feel intoxicating and addictive. So what if I told you that a team of researchers can make that happen in a laboratory between two strangers? It takes 1 hour and 36 questions. But they have to be the right questions.
Given the choice of anyone in the world, whom would you want as a dinner guest?
Would you like to be famous? In what way?
Before making a telephone call, do you ever rehearse what you're going to say?
What would constitute a perfect day for you?
When did you last sing to yourself?
Or to someone else?
If you were able to live to the age of 90 and retain either the mind or body of a 30-year-old for the last 60 years of your life, which would you want?
Do you have a secret hunch about how you will die?
For what in your life do you feel most grateful?
If you could change anything about the way you were raised, what would it be?
If you could wake up tomorrow having gained any one quality or ability, what would it be?
If a crystal ball could tell you the truth about yourself, your life, the future, or anything else, what would you want to know?
Is there something you've dreamed of doing for a long time? Why haven't you done it?
What is the greatest accomplishment of your life?
What do you value most in a friendship?
What is your most treasured memory?
What is your most terrible memory?
If you knew that in 1 year you would die suddenly,
would you change anything about the way you're living now?
What does friendship mean to you?
What roles do love and affection play in your life?
How close and warm is your family?
Of all the people in your family, whose death would you find the most disturbing?
How do you feel about your relationship with your mother?
What if anything is too serious to be joked about?
When did you last cry in front of another person?
Or by yourself?
If you were to die this evening with no opportunity to communicate with anyone,
what would you most regret not having told someone?
Why haven't you told them yet?
Those are some questions, huh? I mean, some of them I haven't even asked myself, let alone anyone else. Imagine asking them on a blind date. 20 years ago, psychologist Arthur Aaron designed those questions for a study on love and intimacy, and he used them in a famous experiment.
A man and a woman, heterosexual, walk into a lab. Each is told that the other knows a little bit about them and is interested in meeting them, and then they sit across from each other. They answer these 36 questions, and then they stare into each other's eyes without speaking for 4 minutes. And one couple who did the study later went on to get married.
Mandy Lynn Catron wrote a column for the New York Times recently called To Fall in Love with Anyone, Do This. It's the story of how 20 years after that experiment, she read about it and then tried it herself one night with a guy she'd just met. And they fell in love, too.
We were at a bar in Vancouver. We had been at the Vancouver Art Gallery, and we went out for beer after. And we were just sort of chatting about relationships. And he was saying, I have this theory that you could fall in love with anyone, you know, assuming you have a certain number of common interests. And then I remembered this study, and I said, well, actually, you know, someone has tried to make people fall in love in the lab. And said, you know, I've always wanted to try it. And he was like, let's do it. And so we did.
How well did you know this guy when you started?
Not that well. Like, it was, that night was the first night that we'd hung out, just the two of us.
And did you feel anything start to shift or change as you were asking these questions?
So the original study is designed to take 90 minutes. We spent probably twice that amount of time talking. And I did feel like I went from not really knowing this person to knowing him quite well over just a few hours. I think it would be hard to really honestly answer the questions and not feel that way.
And did he feel the same way, do you think?
I think so, yeah.
So then what happened? You get all the way through the questions, then what?
The second component of the study is that you stare into each other's eyes for 4 minutes. And he was like, well, like, do you think maybe we should do that too? And kind of hesitated. So we walked down the street to the bridge because we wanted to go somewhere that wasn't too crowded, and did the 4-minute staring in the eyes. It was very uncomfortable.
What was uncomfortable?
It was a good experience. I think you just have to be kind of brave to just look at someone and let someone look at you for that amount of time. I mean, at least the first couple of minutes were pretty uncomfortable.
What changed?
You kind of settle into the experience. You sort of drift out of that sense of, like, looking into someone's soul or whatever, into just sort of being really present in the moment. And I don't know. Other people would probably have different experiences, but that was mine.
And then are you guys together now?
We are, yeah.
Oh, wait, say more. So you did actually wind up falling in love with each other?
Yeah, but it didn't happen right away. It's been interesting seeing the response to the article because it wasn't like we started a relationship right away. We really just started a friendship and then spent a few months deciding whether or not it was going to become something more than that.
Hmm. Do you still stare into each other's eyes?
Occasionally, yeah.
That's Mandy Len Catron's story. She wrote it for the New York Times Modern Love column. So what is it about those 36 questions? Arthur Aaron is the social psychologist who came up with them. He's a researcher at UC Berkeley and Stony Brook University, and he's been studying love and intimacy for a long time. Arthur, were you really trying to see if you could make two strangers fall in love?
We were trying to create a laboratory procedure to create a feeling of closeness between people, not necessarily romantic closeness. But that's not to say it couldn't support the creation of a romantic feeling.
So you basically took two perfect strangers, people who'd never met before, gave them a bunch of questions, and watched to see if they got closer over the course of an hour?
Yes, and we kept piloting it till we made sure it did get them closer. And then we and others, there's been hundreds of studies using this procedure now, it works. At the end of this 45 minutes or so of the activity, people report being almost as close, feeling almost as close to this person as the closest person in their life. Now, it doesn't necessarily last, but at that moment, they're feeling an extreme sense of connection.
And what was it you were trying to find out?
We're trying to understand basic processes in human experience and behavior, and closeness is a huge part of it. So we wanted to have something we could do in the laboratory, randomly assign people to get close or not, and then measure something. The physiological effects of getting close, or we can see whether closeness causes a change in attitudes, all sorts of things.
So what happens after the study participants, these strangers, they come into a room, they ask and answer all these questions, they feel really close, and then what, at the end of the hour, they have to leave? Don't they want to see each other again?
Some of them do, some of them don't. And in fact, when we were doing versions of this with cross-sex heterosexual couples, and we had a little more romantic version of this, we made sure they left separately so they didn't feel any obligation to connect with the person.
So you did one couple, right, in one of the early studies who actually did wind up falling in love and getting married?
We don't know for sure they fell in love, but they did get married, and we presume they fell in love. I don't remember if they actually invited us to the wedding, but they certainly let us know they were getting married. And I actually contacted them a few years ago, and they were still together.
Huh. Well, so the point, it seems to me, is that these are not some magic questions. It's the process of self-revelation, right, and finding out about each other that fosters intimacy and opens the door to falling in love.
It certainly fosters intimacy when it's mutual, gradually built. If you reveal too much too fast, you put someone off. And the responsiveness, feeling the other is responsive to you, feeling yourself being responsive to the other person, have a huge effect in creating intimacy. Now, falling in love, we haven't tested it for that. And we know a fair amount about what creates romantic attraction. And certainly feeling a connection to the other person is a part of that, but it's only one part of it. So, you know, if you were with someone of the wrong age or wrong gender wrong species, well, though people fall in love with their pets. But in general, they have to be reasonably attractive, and you have to be at a point in your life where it's, you don't have to be, but typically it's more likely if you're at a point in your life where it's appropriate to fall in love with someone. All those things have to be in place.
Right. So you've been fascinated by love for a long time. How and why we fall in love, how we do or don't manage to stay in love. We all know that passion and intense involvement fades. Why is that? Why does passion fade?
Well, let me say first, it doesn't always. We've done some studies with people who've been married 30, 40 years who claim to be very intensely in love. There aren't a lot of them, but there are some. We put them in the brain scanner, the fMRI, and they show, when they're thinking about their partner, the same neural response we see with newly in love people.
Wait, these are people who've been married like 30 years and they still are completely in love with their partner?
Yes, I remember Bianca Acevedo, who was the lead on this study. This was her dissertation study. She told me she interviewed one of the couples and she could see it, but they were saying to her, "We really annoy our friends." These were like 70-year-old people. "We really annoy our friends because we're always all over each other physically."
Who are these lucky people? What do they have going on in their brains that the rest of us don't?
Well, we'd like to know. We'd love to do that study. It's hard to get funding to do that kind of research. But we do know some factors that definitely increase passionate love in long-term couples. One of them is actually doing those 36 questions with another couple. So if you just recently met another couple and the two couples get together, spend an evening, do those 36 questions, we just published a study a month ago showing that it not only makes you close to the other couple, it makes you closer to your own partner and actually increases the passionate love with your partner.
So double dating actually improves your own relationship?
Yes.
Why would that be?
Two things. One is we have a lot of research evidence that doing anything novel, challenging with your partner reinvigorates a sense of excitement with the partner. And this is an activity that's like that. We've done other studies where we measure this in other ways. So we have people come into the lab and we tie them together at the wrist and ankles and have them go back and forth trying to push something with their head. And we've done studies where people every week do something from a list of things that are exciting. And after 10 weeks, they're more satisfied and more in love.
What's on the list? What are the exciting things?
We were talking about things they could do in one evening or one afternoon, you know, going for a canoe trip. If they've never been to the opera, going to the opera. If they've never been to a horse race, going to a horse race. Doing something different. We've done some recent research suggesting it doesn't have to be something entirely new. It can be what we call a rediscovery activity, something you haven't done in years. My wife and I were walking back from a play in Manhattan to the subway one night, and we, you know, were somewhat older, and we walked by a bar, and we said, you know, we haven't hung out in a bar in years. Let's go and hang out in a bar for a half hour. It was wonderful.
And why do you think doing something exciting and novel can reignite the spark in a marriage or a partnership?
We associate the process of expanding the self when it's rapid expansion of the self is very has a very rewarding experience. It feels really good. You know, in the early stages of falling in love, there's all that excitement. But then you get used to the partner. So then you do something together that's exciting, and you associate that with the partner.
Hmm.
One of the things that happens when we connect with someone is the other person becomes part of who we are to some extent. So what a relationship does for us is it expands the self in the sense it increases who we feel we are.
So we feel bigger.
We feel bigger. We want to be more than we are. We want to grow to be bigger in the sense of more abilities to accomplish things.
Is there something you've learned over the course of your research that you wish you'd known back in the earlier days of your marriage?
Well, I think another example is some great research by that's been done on what's called capitalization, that is celebrating your partner's successes. It turns out that that has a bigger effect than supporting your partner when things go badly. And so we systematically try to do that. My wife had a really important paper that she thought didn't have a chance of being accepted in one of the top scientific journals. And I was home when the email came in, and I happened to see it, that the paper had not only been accepted, but the editor loved it. So I made a poster of that email and put it on the front door for when she arrived. We had a great night that night.
That's lovely.
So,
Arthur,
so we try to make use of whatever we can from the research.
Okay, thanks. I'm going home to make a list of novel and exciting activities.
Yes, do so.
Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Arthur Aaron studies love and intimacy at UC Berkeley and Stony Brook University. He also developed those 36 questions. Coming up, comedian and NPR host Ophira Eisenberg has some questions of her own.
God forbid something happened and I was out dating again, I would ask different questions. I would not ask, what's your job like? What's your relationship like with your family? I would ask, do you put your stuff away?
I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio, NPRI, Public Radio International. It's an hour of love by the numbers today. When Ophira Eisenberg moved to New York and began dating, she approached love kind of like a science experiment. The larger the sample size, the more useful the data. In the end, her magic number was 40 first dates. You may know Ophira as the host of NPR's Ask Me Another, but she's also written a really funny and definitely not for broadcast memoir about her dating days. It's called Screw Everyone: Sleeping My Way to Monogamy. Sarah Nix sat down with her for some girl talk.
You know, I don't know if you saw this, but a couple of years ago, this idea went around, like, if you really want to succeed at dating, and I guess succeed means get married,
right,
then you should date lots and lots of people. And you should just cycle through as many people as you can to try to figure out what you want. And it sounds kind of like that's what you did.
Quantity. Yeah, I didn't set out to do that. I didn't, like, wake up one day at 15 years old and I was like, all right, 200 people, let's do this, Ophira, or whatever. I wasn't even close to that. But it was something that ended up happening. I always had sex on the first date. How else do you know when it ends? Like, really, how else do you? I wasn't slutty. I was giving closure. I actually never thought I was slutty. I just thought I was being nice. But and then I wrote a book, like, talking about how many people that I was with over the years and all these guys.
I feel like I almost did every length possible. I did years. I did months. I did weeks. I did days. I did nights. I've done every possibility. I had many long-term relationships, 2, 3 years, 1 year. But nothing felt particularly right.
You were already telling these stories on stage, but was there a moment of, it can be tricky and it can push people's buttons to share stories about kind of a sexual freedom and experimentation that maybe doesn't fit in every part of North American culture.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I didn't really – it wasn't until I started – people started reading it and I started getting feedback from the public or the press where I was asked questions like, well, aren't you ashamed of what you've done? And I was like, what? No. Why would I be ashamed? What? I didn't do anything wrong. And then I started understanding that I was part of a larger political argument, even though I wrote a book that was supposed to be entertainment, or that is entertainment, and it's comedy.
So we went back to his apartment, and I've never seen this before. He stood in front of the closed door to his bedroom and said, I have something very special to show you. 35-year-old man, his room was filled with about 300 Garfields. Garfields! I didn't get it. I was like, if I do well, do I get one? Is that...
When I moved here, there was the statistic that everyone used to throw around that there was like 8 women for every one guy. The women, I felt like I met all these amazing, cool women that I felt so much lesser than, yet they would be crying into their blood orange margaritas being like, why doesn't he call me? And I found it really troubling. And I saw the attitude in the guys, and I retaliated against it because that is my nature. And I was just like, you know what? Fine. This is how this game plays. I'm playing it too. So here's how it goes. I don't care. I'm going to take what I want. I'm not looking to settle down. Not very important to me right now. So I'm going to have some fun. And, you know, it was very liberating.
It's pretty great to set your own terms. That's a pretty rewarding thing. Well, we should talk about what's in the book.
Sure.
So we kind of wander with you through a bunch of relationships and sexual encounters and the like. And you write early on in the book that while most of your high school friends were kind of classically dreamy-eyed around ideas of love and marriage and virginity and the sacredness thereof, that you just seemed kind of more curious and adventurous about the whole endeavor.
Yeah, I'm the youngest of 6, and I think it has something to do with having adventurous, rebellious, sex positive, or, you know, enjoying men, older sisters who had lots of relationships and went out a lot and were just always telling me stories and having boyfriends over. And they were kind of there, you know, the humor in my family is kind of sarcastic. They would be like, oh, yeah, you think it works out like it does in the movies? It doesn't work out like it does in the movies.
Right.
You think losing your virginity is going to be beautiful? It's a disaster. I have done some crazy, dumb things. I mean, some of them are in the past. I was young. I was 18. I couldn't handle a breakup. And then finally, one friend just went, oh, Ophira, why don't you just put a curse on him through a Haitian witch doctor? And I was like, yeah, finally some advice.
You call this your anti-romantic phase? And I went through an anti-romantic phase for about 2 years. And I got to be honest, I mean, it was liberating in a way. I felt a sense of empowerment.
Yes.
I also found it boring.
You know, I hear what you're saying because you're skimming the surface more. And it's a little bit more about like having a good time rather than building something. And I did miss that, but I had to get to the point where I missed it. I don't know if that's how it felt to you.
I guess what was boring for me, I guess if I like somebody enough to sleep with them, I probably like them enough to harbor romantic notions.
Yeah. I fought against it a little bit, to be honest with you, because I was like, I really was trying to look at it a little bit more like, why can't I enjoy the physical nature of this without turning around and being like, how much do you like me? I just wanted to remove that because I didn't want to be powerless and I didn't want to give it up to someone who wasn't going to be the right person for me. And I didn't know who the right person was. I've had so many great conversations. My favorite was a guy leaned into me, pack train leans in and goes, guess where I spent the last 15 years? I'm like, Peru? He's like, no, prison. And I was like, oh, okay. Did you go to jail for being a smooth criminal?
Throughout the book, you kind of characterize yourself as a girl who can't say no. But of course, you also didn't say no when your now husband proposed.
No.
Tell that story a little bit. We're putting this interview in an hour called Love by the Numbers. And actually, the numbers came around to mean something else in the end for you.
Yeah. You know, so I was just because I was raised with this idea that if I just, you know, kind of was like, and then I get married and blah, blah, blah. Listener, if you have done that with your life, I'm very happy for you. It was just not my path. But I just thought that would be me settling. Then I meet this nice guy, and he doesn't seem to be a player. He doesn't seem to be pretending he's something that he's not. And it's nice. It is a nice relationship. It feels like the kind of thing that you go, this would be worthwhile, you know, going from renting to maybe a 2-year lease. Maybe I want to own.
And when we moved in together, which was a big moment, he puts a box that is sealed shut in the closet, tells me that I'm not allowed to look in the box, which freaks me out and sends me on a path of, you know, we can't move in together if you have secrets. That's not what relationships are built on. And he was like, no, you are never allowed to look in that box. So I went with the ignorance is bliss, put luggage in front of that box, and walked away for a couple years. And then one day I came back home after failing at a gig. He had made some dinner and that box was out. He started folding a crane. Jonathan, my now husband, he is into the Japanese art of folding origami cranes. Not a very cool hobby, I understand. And so he finished folding this crane and he said, you know, in Japanese folklore, in a very presentational voice, like he's addressing a crowd, he's like, in Japanese folklore, there's all these stories about 1,000 cranes. Like if you give someone 1,000 cranes, it brings them health or it brings them fortune. He goes, but the one I love the best is if you give someone you love 1,000 cranes, your love will last forever. And then he hands it to me and says, this is number 1,000. And I'm like, wow, great story. Yeah, I just see one. And then he guides my eyes to that box. It is filled with 999 paper folded cranes that this guy had folded over the years when he was single, thinking, I'm just going to start folding these cranes. And maybe when I reach 1,000, the love of my life would be standing in front of me. And he proposed to me. And of course, there's no way you can say no in that moment. And I wanted to say yes, but I also just wanted to take a moment and be like, hey, can we just count the cranes? You know, like just to make sure there's 1,000 here.
That's Ophira Eisenberg talking with Sarah Nix. Ophira is a comedian and host of NPR's Ask Me Another. Her memoir is called Screw Everyone. So maybe the secret to finding and keeping love is math. John and Julie Gottman have studied thousands of couples in minute detail. They've collected reams of data, and they're famous for being able to predict with 94% accuracy whether a couple will break up, stay together and be unhappy, or stay together and be happy. Sounds like magic, but actually, they told Steve Paulson, it's math.
Remember the old experiment we used to do in high school where we take iron filings and put it on a piece of paper and put a magnet under the paper, and we'd see the force field of the magnet,
the magnetic field.
Right. So, well, what we found is that there is actually a vector field, a force field, when two people who love each other are talking to one another. And the math explains it.
Wow. Now, Julie, I know that you've developed these ingenious ways to study relationships. I mean, for instance, you've designed a lab that looks like a B&B, and you bring couples in there and you watch them. You watch how they interact with each other, which I have to say is kind of daunting to feel like these experts are watching, you know, how good you are at your relationship. What are some of the most important things you've found?
Well, in part we found, and this was very, very subtle, that when a partner makes a bid for connection, just calling out the other partner's name, for example, how does that other partner respond? If they turn towards the other person and respond to their bid for attention, that's very, very important. If they say nothing, that's not good.
You're talking about in very kind of mundane situations. I don't know. I mean, you're sitting down for breakfast. You're both kind of getting ready for work. And one person puts out an offering there. You know, oh, did you see this in the newspaper, something like that? And that conversation can then play out very differently from there on.
Exactly. The apartment lab sat on the Montlake Cut. It was beautiful. So boats would go by. So if one person was looking out the window and said, wow, look at that beautiful boat, and the other person said nothing, we'd call that turning away. If the other person said, that was turning towards, just the smallest response made a tremendous difference in whether or not couples became friends and stayed friends in their relationship over time.
Because basically you're demonstrating whether or not you show interest in your partner.
Yeah. Not only that, Steve, but guess what couples mostly argue about?
What?
It's not money, sex, in-laws, drugs. It's really the failure of the bids to connect. That's what couples argue about.
You're saying they basically argue about nothing.
That's right. They argue about nothing. But when you look at the, you know, the details of it, when you do what Malcolm Gladwell calls thin slicing, you see these attempts to really get close that have been ignored or responded to with irritability. And that's what they're fighting about.
Yeah. Huh. So what's a good fight then?
Well, that's a great question. So a good fight, first of all, begins by what we call a softened startup. So John found in his research that the first 3 minutes of a conflict conversation predicts not only how the rest of the conversation will go, but how the rest of the relationship will go. So a softened startup might sound like, you know, I'm a little bit upset. So they describe their own feelings. Then they describe about what. I'm upset that the bills haven't been paid. Then they state what they need to make it better. Would you please pay the bills tonight? A bad fight, in contrast, would begin with what we call a harsh startup, which would sound like, what's the matter with you? Are you too lazy to pay the bills? It's a criticism.
I want to come back to this thing that you said, that you can determine this within the first 3 minutes of a conversation. I mean, you have this amazing number. I mean, apparently, 96% of the time you can predict the outcome of a conversation based on how the first 3 minutes are going to go.
That's right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. We were as surprised by that as, you know, as anybody else.
Well, you've come up with these phrases. You sort of divided couples into two groups. There are the masters and the disasters.
Right.
What are the basic differences?
Well, you know, we have very low standards for what a master is. So, you know, the couples who more or less like each other over time and stay together, those are the masters. They're putting energy into romance and being kind to each other. The disasters really are constantly scanning their partner's behavior and looking for their partner's mistakes, trying to improve their partner. The masters are much more accepting.
Mm-hmm. Let me add to that. The masters and the disasters both criticize, may get even contemptuous or defensive sometimes, but the masters try to repair quickly.
Explain what you mean by repair.
Well, a repair would be something like, you know, I'm sorry the way I started this conversation. Can I start over again? What I'm trying to say is I really need you to, you know, greet me with affection when I come home. You know, that's what I wanted to say in the first place. And I'm sorry I started off being such a jerk about it. That's a repair. Mm. The most effective repair is taking responsibility even for a part of the problem. So if you say, you know, that's a good point, honey. I mean, you know, I probably was pretty grumpy. You know, tell me more. This is the most powerful repair of all. And it's even more powerful when a woman does it for a guy.
Why is that?
Because men really feel like, you know, they're the ones who are always at fault. You know that old joke, if a man speaks in a forest and there's not a woman to hear him, is he still wrong? So guys always feel like, you know, women are saying all the problem is theirs.
So does this mean that guys are more sensitive to criticism or that women are more prone to offer criticism?
You don't agree with me? I think men are more sensitive to criticism.
No, they're not more sensitive to criticism. I think women are quite sensitive to criticism too. But I think here's the big difference. Women feel like they are guardians of the relationship. It's up to them to keep the relationship strong. But what that means is that they're bringing up problems that they see in the relationship. The difficulty is that they don't know how to bring up the problem in ways that are more helpful as opposed to critical.
More gentle.
Right.
Mm-hmm. 80% of the time, it's women who bring up the problem. Julie's right.
That's interesting. So if women are the ones who tend to be sort of the caretakers of the relationship, the overseeing the health of the relationship, what's the guy's role in this?
Well, see, that's a very interesting thing because men play a really critical role. So before our conflict discussion, Bob Levinson and I had couples just talk about how their day went. And the guys who were disinterested, not very positive, they get this harsh startup from their women. So I remember this one guy who said, yeah, why don't you talk about your day? It won't take you very long. So right away, he started with a contemptuous statement, right? Or another guy who, as his wife was talking about something really interesting to her that happened to their two-year-old, he was looking bored, looking at his watch, you know, communicating his boredom. Well, they had harsh startup. So guys are really important in turning toward these bids.
I want to come back to this sort of this use of math that you have. I mean, you've come up with a whole series of what you call love equations. And you throw around terms like nonlinear differential equations and emotional velocity and inertia, emotional vector force field. I mean, the kind of stuff that I would expect to read in a physics book, not discussions about love.
Well, I started my career in math and physics, and the numbers allow you to discover patterns that are really invisible to clinicians. For example, Bob Levinson did a study where he took the first 3 minutes of conflict for five couples who eventually divorced and five couples who stayed together. And he had experts try to tell for the first 3 minutes which ones would divorce and which ones would stay together. And nobody was better than chance at doing it. But when you get the numbers, we can discriminate with over 90% accuracy.
When you say you get the numbers, what do you mean? What are you adding up?
Well, we're really looking at a whole variety of things. First of all, we're looking at facial expressions, voice patterns and behaviors and the way people look at each other, how they respond to one another. We're actually looking at their heart rate, how fast their blood is flowing, how much they're sweating from the palms of their hands. And we put those in terms of numbers. And the numbers wind up telling us these differences. So we get kind of a real subtle discrimination between what makes a relationship work and what makes it fall apart.
So you have more than 40 what you call principles of love.
Right.
So I hate to ask this, but if there is one takeaway that you can leave us with, you know, one thing that you wish every couple listening to this would sort of go home and try, what would it be?
I think the most important principle is empathy, actually, is to turn towards your partner and listen with empathy. What we have found is that it makes a huge difference. So if John hears me complaining about something in the relationship and he responds in the way that he has lately, which is heaven, by saying, honey, what do you need? I fall over in bliss. I'm so happy. So, you know, it's that kind of response, turning toward and turning toward with empathy, that really makes a difference.
She's really smart.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Marriage researchers John and Julie Gottman talking with Steve Paulson. I don't know if you know, but Steve Paulson is not just my co-producer. We've been married for more than 20 years. Listening to him do that interview was a tiny bit like couples therapy, which may be more than you wanted to know. If you're curious about the Gottmans' research, you can check it out at the Gottman Institute. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now it's time for A Dangerous Idea.
My name is Joshua Wolfshank. I'm a curator and the author of Powers of Two, a book about creative intimacy. And my dangerous idea is that solitude is a part of connection, and connection is a part of solitude. We tend to think of being alone as something entirely separate from being in the company of other people. But in fact, when we're alone and being creative and living a vibrant life in our minds, we are doing that in a kind of imagined dialogue, often with real people as our correspondent, so to speak, sometimes with a model that we've developed from conversations over time with other people. The capacity for solitude is an enormously advanced mental function that proceeds from a very sophisticated and well-developed sense of relationships. In fact, one mark of mental illness is an inability to be alone. And one mark of extreme dysfunction, short of mental illness, is an inability to be alone and to be okay with it and to be able to generate new ideas. And so when we look at creativity, we need to see that solitude needs to be protected and nourished and understood as something that exists to bring important things out of the mind into a connection with other people. Very often that interplay is at the root of the things that we care about the most, from literature to technology to great activism. One intriguing example for me is Paul McCartney and the song Blackbird, which he recorded alone in Abbey Road in a room that wasn't even big enough for any of the other Beatles to be, and it was just him and an engineer. And this was, in a way, a solo McCartney composition. And yet, when you look at where it came in the cycle of their work, it was also very clearly a response to John Lennon's song Revolution. And so this idea of being alone with his mind and his thoughts was also a kind of conversation between McCartney and Lennon.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly. All your life you were only waiting for this moment to arrive. You were only waiting for this moment to arise. You were only waiting for this moment to arise.
That's Joshua Wolfshank's Dangerous Idea. As federal courts continue to uphold gay marriage, more and more same-sex couples are exchanging rings and signing marriage licenses. These days, it's almost hard to remember, but there was originally a progressive wing of the gay liberation movement that was not at first in favor of gay marriage. Among them, Edmund White. He's a novelist and cultural critic who's witnessed and written about 5 decades of gay liberation. He was there at the Stonewall riots. He watched his closest friends die of AIDS. And today, he lives with his husband, writer Michael Carroll, but he still has somewhat mixed feelings about gay marriage.
For a long time, I guess I was opposed to what I called gay assimilation. I thought that gays should live in a very exemplary but utterly different way from straight people, and that we were sort of the vanguard pointing the way to new kinds of association.
It was kind of an opportunity. Rather than mimic a heterosexual, quote-unquote, normal lifestyle, it was an opportunity to create an entirely new and different lifestyle.
Most of us who were openly gay in the 70s were fairly radical in politics. I mean, that we had been active in other movements like Black Liberation, Women's Liberation, anti-war movement. So we had a kind of radical mentality, which meant that we didn't want to just imitate this most traditional of all institutions, marriage.
So this was the 70s.
The 70s.
And a real kind of golden age. So just to contrast, when you were in the 60s, you were working at Time Life Books, and, you know, this was kind of the Mad Men era. How would you get from Time Life Books down to the Village and to the bar scene? Was it like putting on a whole different identity for yourself?
Yeah, it was like Superman. I mean that you wore a coat and tie during the day, and to your office mates, friends, you would talk about, you'd make up if let's say you're growing out with a 6'3" blonde boy, you'd say, talk about growing out with a 5'6" blonde girl, and invent her name, and it made you very good at lying, because not only did you have to invent plausible stories, but you also had to remember them. So you'd write down notes about all your lies and fictions that you'd created.
You'd actually write them down?
Yeah. So you'd remember them. I mean, if you wanted to have a personal life and talk about it to your straight friends who were confiding in you, you had to tell them something, but you couldn't tell them the truth because you would get fired. So you made up all this stuff.
Sounds like great training for a novelist.
Perfect training for a novelist.
The wonderful thing about talking with you is that you have lived through and written through the evolution of gay life over more than 5 decades of what has been one of the most momentous social changes in history. So by the time you came back to New York, then it's the 70s and everything has changed. Was it possible to be much more out at that point?
I used to think of the gay community as being very small. But suddenly it seemed like everybody was gay. I mean, there were hundreds of them. And I guess just a whole new atmosphere had come along.
You write about that period of time. The men you knew and were friends with and slept with were writers and artists. It just sounds like it was this incredibly sophisticated, beautiful crowd.
The admission ticket to being gay in those days was being cultured. And you had to have read lots of things, or at least pretended to. And you had to go to the opera. You had to have opinions about this and that. And you had to have traveled in Europe and so on. I mean, there was a kind of pressure to be a very civilized being.
And that's different now?
Oh, yeah. Now all you have to do is go to the gym and be cute.
Of course, you were also... Even then, I mean, we were talking about the promiscuous lifestyle. Being cute was pretty important then, too.
Well, I think that gay life at that time, especially, a gay man had to be as beautiful as a woman and as successful as a man. Because like on Fire Island, you'd see these beautiful boys with big muscles wandering around. And then you'd find out they were a brain surgeon or a lawyer or a CEO of a company. But these were very accomplished pretty boys. And that kind of double burden, I think, was very difficult for many people to sustain, because it was as though you were running in a race that nobody ever won, because you were getting older every year. You maybe weren't as rich as the next person, and you had to be both successful and beautiful.
And then along comes AIDS, and so many of those men were the first to go.
That's right. Partly because they were radical in their politics and experimental in their sexuality. And they died, and they were oftentimes replaced by much squarer middle class people, much more conservative people.
You're being polite. In print, you called them the dull normals.
Oh, well, you have too good a memory.
I was going to ask you, who are these poor guys you're calling dull normals?
Well, recently I wrote an article about gay marriage for the New York Review of Books, and it was mainly a reporting job, I mean, to talk about the whole battle against Proposition 8 in California. And I said that the two heterosexual lawyers who had represented the gay side of things in the court case on Proposition 8, they concluded their book by saying, and now we can see that gay people are just like everyone else, that they, too, are good members of the community and go to the PTA and blah, blah, blah. And I thought, wait a minute, I'm not sure that's the gay world I've been fighting for.
Sounds like you're saying there was a politics to the choice of a promiscuous sexual lifestyle.
And a romance. I think that everybody assumes that anonymous sex must be very cold-blooded, and yet some of the most ecstatic nights I've ever spent in my life were with somebody whose name I didn't know, but who, after all, only takes a short while to have sex. And then you talk to the person all night long. And there are these kind of intense moments of communion that oftentimes follow what's, pick up sex.
Well, so you maintained that lifestyle through and beyond
the decade of AIDS. I mean, there were a lot of medical experts and probably friends of yours who said, oh, we should just all become celibate for until they figure this disease out.
Yes. The very first meeting where I ever heard a doctor talk about AIDS was in 1981 in the apartment of Larry Kramer, who eventually became the big leader of ACT UP. And this doctor, Friedman Keene, he said, well, we don't know what causes it or how to stop it. My suggestion is you should all be celibate. Well, to say that to a room full of case-hardened gays who are in their 20s and 30s just seemed utterly preposterous.
I guess what I don't understand, especially during that period of time, sex was killing people. Mm-hmm. If you knew it was a choice between sex or death, wouldn't you choose to give up sex?
It turns out no. that it was too much of a part of our lives, and it was what we really... I mean, for my generation, in the 50s and 60s, we hadn't had very much sex. We didn't have many opportunities for meeting other gay people, since all the bars were closed, since it was illegal to cruise, since if anybody found out on your job that you were gay, you'd be fired. You'd be pushed out of your apartment if your landlord knew you were gay. I mean, it was criminalized. And so when gay liberation came along, I think that the liberation part meant for people my age, sexual liberation. And then to have only 10 years later to have all that disappear and somebody blow a whistle, it was just intolerable in that we hope to play Russian roulette with our health. In my own case, I found out I was positive in 1985, but I was fortunately one out of every 100 people is what they call a slow progressor, which means, yes, you're infected, yes, your T cell counts are going down, but so slowly that by the time mine were dangerously low, the new medications had come on stream.
But you couldn't have known that right away. You must have thought it was your death sentence.
I did. And I just pulled the covers over my head when I found out in 1985 that I was positive. And I thought, oh, I'll be dead in a year or two. And then eventually I realized, oh, my God, I guess I'll go on living. So I better do something.
Edmund White has done a lot. He's published novels, essays, and a whole bunch of gossipy, honest memoirs. The most recent is called Inside a Pearl, My Years in Paris. If you like this conversation, subscribe to our podcast. That way you can listen to the show whenever and wherever you want. Just visit our website and click on the podcast link. It's at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison, Wisconsin. The show is produced by Sarah Nix, Charles Monroe Kane, Doug Gordon, Raymond Tungekar, and Craig Ely. Steve Mullen at Walk West Music wrote our theme music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.